It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Parrott. Coming up, now that warmer weather is starting to arrive in fits and starts, mosquitoes are on their way. We'll talk to a science journalist about some of the efforts to genetically modify mosquitoes to help control the population around the world.
First, how should Wisconsin's prisoners spend their time behind bars? It's a question our guest says all Wisconsinites have a stake in, because almost all inmates will eventually be released back into society.
That's why he's making the case for implementing a good conduct time policy in state prisons. Wisconsin has the highest incarceration rate for black men of any state in the country, and despite having a similar population in Minnesota, has twice the number of incarcerated people.
Here with us to explain good conduct time is Michael O'Hear, Associate Dean for Research and Professor of Law at Marquette Law School. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, can you start by explaining what good conduct time is?
Sure. Good conduct time is a program that allows prison inmates to earn credits toward an accelerated release from prison. Now, I refer to this sometimes as good conduct time. In a lot of states, it's referred to as good time, and that's, I guess, a little less of a mouthful to say, so maybe we should refer to it as good time now. But it is a program that is in use in most American states. It's in use in the federal prison system. It's even in use in Wisconsin in our jails, our county locally administered penal facilities, but it is not something which is done in the state prison system.
You said it's in use in other states. How does it affect release times there?
Well, it varies a lot from state to state. There are some states which allow inmates to earn day-for-day credit. So, in other words, every day that the inmate manages to avoid disciplinary problems and otherwise complies with the institutional requirements. Every day the inmate does that, the inmate earns 1 day's extra credit, so that in effect the prison term could be cut in half. That's at the outside of what some states do. There are other states which are much more limited in the amount of credit that they give. So maybe in some other states you would only be able to reduce the length of your prison term by 10% to 15%. And, of course, all of this, when we talk about reducing prison term, is assuming that the prisoner stays out of trouble and complies with all the requirements of the Good Time program.
Well, let's talk a little more specifically about what an inmate has to do to earn it. What sorts of things might they do to get credit?
Well, first and foremost, the inmate needs to stay out of trouble to avoid disciplinary infractions. Now, there are some states where that's all an inmate needs to do, is to stay out of trouble to get the maximum credit. There are other states which require that the inmate also either do employment or education or rehabilitative programming. And actually, those are the states that I think have had the best success with good time programs. And that's the sort of program which I think should be considered for Wisconsin, a program which would require both staying out of trouble and also doing something constructive like employment or education or some other kind of rehabilitative programming.
Can you make the case for why it matters how inmates spend their time when they're in prison?
Well, absolutely. People who go to prison almost always come back from prison. The number of life sentences that we hand out in Wisconsin and nationally is very, very small relative to the overall size of the prison population. So we send these people away, but they're going to come back, and they're going to come back within the space of a few years, most of them. So we should care an awful lot about how they are spending their time in prison, because that is going to have a big impact on what happens to them when they return to the community. It has an impact on recidivism, that is to say, the likelihood that they will commit additional crimes once released from prison. And the way that they spend their time in prison also has other effects as well. It affects their ability to reintegrate with their families, to step back into positions of family responsibility, their ability to get employment and become contributing members of the community, become taxpayers, and so forth. So we send people away to prison. Almost all of them are going to come back again. And we should all want them to be successful when they come back. We should all care a lot about whether they are reintegrating into the community or not. And you can't expect to send somebody away to a situation where they've got nothing to do for several years and are living in an environment in which they have no hope and no activities. You can't do that and expect them suddenly, upon the time of their release, to be prepared to be productive, law-abiding members of the community again.
On the other hand, one strong point of view on prison is that it's at least in some sense punitive. Do you see it that way?
Well, sure. We send people to prison in part to convey a message of condemnation for behavior that is socially unacceptable. But that that message of condemnation can be sent without then creating a situation in prison where people will come back out and be bound to fail. Sending someone to prison is a pretty tough punishment in and of itself. If you just pause for a moment to think about the kind of deprivations that people suffer in prison, the kind of environment that they're forced to live in. Our prisons in Wisconsin are about 25% over capacity, so these are very crowded environments. They're environments in which one is subject to a great deal of control, daily humiliations and degradations. One's ability to remain in contact with one's family members and friends is profoundly constrained, so on and so forth. So so we have plenty of punishment, plenty of condemnation when we send people away to prison and tell them they have to stay there for a certain period of time. And I'm just suggesting that we think about ways of combining that condemnation with some constructive activities that will prepare people to avoid doing things in the future that that merit further condemnation.
Prison reform is a top agenda item right now as states face big taxpayer burdens, prison overcrowding. How is putting good conduct time in place going to help that, maybe?
Well, I think that good conduct time should be part of a broader set of reforms to sentencing and corrections. Good conduct time has been proven in other states to reduce recidivism rates for prisoners when they're returned to society. Good conduct time also has been demonstrated to reduce rates of disciplinary infractions in prison. And so when you've got good conduct time, the prisons can be run in a safer and more efficient manner because corrections officials aren't having to spend all of their time dealing with disciplinary infractions. So the better environment in prison contributes to the ability for prisoners to use their time more constructively, and then through good conduct credits, they have the incentives to use the time more constructively. So I would see good conduct time as one reform that would certainly help to further a number of important public policy objectives. I've emphasized reducing recidivism rates, reducing disciplinary rates. Over the long run, it can also help reduce the size of the prison population. And, of course, we've got a billion-plus dollar corrections budget here in Wisconsin. It's risen dramatically over the past couple of decades. And taxpayers certainly should have an interest in seeing the size of that corrections budget come down.
Now, when Wisconsin passed Truth in Sentencing, it did away with the parole system. How would this be different than parole?
Well, it's quite different than parole. The parole system that was eliminated through the Truth in Sentencing law in the 1990s, permitted inmates to obtain parole potentially as early as the one-quarter mark in the sentence. So that's in and of itself much more generous than any good time program that I'm aware of, and the kind of good time program that I would suggest that Wisconsin adopt would be modeled on that of Washington State. Washington State permits a maximum one-third reduction in the length of the prison term. So for one thing, good conduct time would keep inmates in prison much longer than the old parole system did. Another issue with the old parole system is that it was seen as being very unpredictable, very subjective. There was a parole commission that would decide whether prisoners were released or not. The criteria that the parole commission used were very vague. And it was very hard for people to, particularly people on the outside, to predict when exactly an inmate would be deemed fit for release under the parole system. But with good conduct time, the criteria are very objective. The amount of credits that can be earned for different behaviors is spelled out very clearly in advance, so everyone knows. The old parole system was said sometimes to spring some nasty surprises on crime victims, that crime victims would all of a sudden learn that the offender is out walking the streets again without any advance warning that might happen. Good conduct time, because it operates in an objective manner, is much easier to keep everybody informed of what's going on. In fact, something that's done in a lot of prison systems is that you can see it all on a publicly accessible website. Go to the Department of Corrections website, type in the information about the offender, and you can see exactly how much good conduct time credit has been earned and what the projected release date is. So what I'm talking about with good conduct time is quite different than the parole system that was eliminated in the 1990s. It's much less generous, it's much more objective, and much more transparent.
Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Michael O'Hear, Associate Dean for Research and Professor of Law at Marquette Law School, making the case for implementing good conduct time in Wisconsin's prisons.
We're all celebrating the gradual, very gradual return of warmer weather to Wisconsin as spring leans towards summer. But with the sunshine and higher temperatures will come the bugs. Today we're talking about one in particular, the mosquito.
Well, mosquitoes are mostly a nuisance here in Wisconsin. They spread dangerous diseases like malaria and dengue fever in other parts of the world. So scientists have tried lots of options to control mosquito populations in an effort to stop these diseases from spreading.
Our next guest is with us to talk about how some researchers are using genetic engineering to control mosquito populations. Jeff Wheelwright is a freelance science writer. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
So why are researchers turning to genetic engineering as an anti-mosquito effort?
Mainly because the other methods haven't worked very well, and I think we're most familiar with spraying mosquitoes. But in the tropics, particularly, mosquitoes have evolved resistance to all the current sprays. DDT still works on them, but DDT is a bad actor, as you know, so we don't want to use that. So they're kind of pulling their hair out. The scientists are trying to figure out new ways to combat them. And genetics, which is much in the news with genetically modified organisms, we're familiar with fruits and vegetables, but you can do the same tinkering with animal and insect populations.
Now, as you write in a piece in Discover Magazine, the idea here is that we create a population of genetically modified mosquitoes and release them into the wild. And this isn't just hypothetical. Some of this is already being worked with now, right?
Yeah, there's a company, a lot of laboratory work has shown that it's feasible. And there's a British company called Oxitec working with governments in the tropics, Brazil, Malaysia, Cayman Islands, and Panama, has done field demonstrations releasing modified male mosquitoes that breed with wild female mosquitoes, and the progeny end up dying before they're mature. So you're reducing the population, at least in that one spot where they do these releases.
So how do they make a male mosquito? How much work is involved in making it so that they breed baby mosquitoes, I guess, that die before they reach adult mosquitohood?
It's pretty complicated, the Oxitec technology. They harvest, let's say, some local eggs, some local Brazilian eggs, and it's one species which spreads dengue fever is the one they're targeting, called Aedes aegypti. But you get the eggs in the laboratory, and with techniques that actually I can't explain very well, they inject a gene which is called a lethal gene construct, and at the same time feed these developing mosquitoes tetracycline, which is an antidote to what the gene, the lethal gene, is producing. So that allows the mosquitoes, the male mosquitoes, and they discard the females, because you don't want to do this technology with females, because females bite. Male mosquitoes do not bite human beings, so you want to just work with males. In any event, you create a male mosquito which is carrying a kind of a time bomb in its genes, and release it into the wild where there is no tetracycline, the antidote that neutralizes the gene. So the male is going to die very soon, but before it does, it homes in on a female, transmits the gene to whether it's a male or female mosquito that's produced, and that mosquito dies before it can breed. And that, but that's the end of the effect. It doesn't spread any farther than one generation down the line.
And another tactic is something that they call, this is one from London, the X shredder. How does that one work?
That one works by inserting a gene again in a male mosquito line, and when the male mosquito produces his sperm, the cells that he produces have a protein which actually attacks the X chromosome, that means that the sperm the sperm that's going to be going down the line to be fertilized is never going to have an X. It's only going to have a Y. Females produce X and X, which means this gets kind of complicated, I know, but you're only creating an X and Y mosquito, which is a male. In other words, you're limiting the supply of females in the population, and this technology has never been tried in the field. It's been demonstrated in the lab.
So how do you get, I mean, you know, both cases, these are male mosquitoes. How do you get your modified mosquitoes, make sure they're the ones breeding the next generation, not the already existing male mosquitoes?
Well, back to the Oxitec strategy, the idea is just to outnumber the wild males. That is, you're releasing, if you go to a backyard and this one particular mosquito is a very localized Aedes aegypti, very localized, can't fly very far. Females are just are right there, and you release a million males, and sure, there's some wild males there too, but the odds are that the male that's going to successfully mate is the modified one. So you're attacking in a very kind of local, if you will, parochial scale, the problem. You're not driving it through the whole population across the country, if you will.
And Jeff, before I let you go, got to ask, there have got to be worries about the ethics of this and possible unintended consequences. What kind of questions are being raised?
Well, primarily whether it's proper for us to be deliberately managing the extinction of a species, and we're causing, you know, in our onslaught on the natural world, indirectly, we're causing extinctions all the time, kind of in our ignorance. I mean, that would maybe be a sin of omission, not paying attention to the damage we're doing. This would be, you know, with the faintly evil overtones of white-coated scientists setting out to destroy, you know, a fellow creature, even as one is as sort of harmful as and unpleasant as a mosquito.
Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
That's been my pleasure.
That was Jeff Wheelwright. He's a freelance science writer with us to talk about a piece he wrote in Discover Magazine looking at some of the ways researchers are exploring genetic engineering as a method of controlling mosquitoes that carry diseases like dengue fever and malaria around the world. A national survey released today shows nearly a third of workers have almost nothing saved for retirement. Results show that workers and retirees have more confidence now than in previous years about being able to afford their retirement, but still not a lot of people taking steps to ensure they're going to be able to retire comfortably.
And we'd love to hear from you on this issue. Do you feel confident that you'll be able to afford to retire when the time comes? What kind of retirement planning have you done so far? If you're already retired, what do you know now that you wished you'd known before you retired? Call in and share your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Craig Copeland is with us now. He's a senior research associate at the Employee Benefit Research Institute, and he's a co-author of this 2015 Retirement Confidence Survey. Craig, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been doing this retirement confidence survey for some years now. What are you trying to measure? What are you trying to get at from the people of the United States?
Well, we're trying to see if they feel they're prepared to have a financially secure retirement and trying to see what steps people are taking to get there. And as you mentioned in your intro, people are feeling a little more confident this year, but they aren't really taking those steps. Even the basic step of trying to calculate what they'll need in retirement isn't being done, and the number hasn't been moving for the last 5 years for the percentage that have done that.
Well, let's look at some of the bad news here. What are people looking at the low end of the spectrum here? How many people are we seeing with little or no retirement money stashed away?
Well, for workers at the low end at less than $1,000 outside of their home, it's about 28% of the workers, but there is a huge dichotomy between those that have a retirement plan, such as a DB or DC, a pension plan or a 401k plan from their employer, or an IRA. You can see that percentage that has that such a low amount for those people is only 9% compared to 64% without such of those plans. So certainly those people that don't have a retirement plan are those that are predominantly in that less than $1,000 savings amount.
So you said, and we mentioned at the outset, there's some more confidence now. Is that just a matter of, you know, the economy's been improving over the last few years once we got through the worst of the Great Recession?
That certainly is. You can see that both the stock market has had now two good years. The labor market, unemployment rate's been going down. So that is certainly playing into that. And it seems like there's a lag between when those things turn around and when confidence is coming up because, you know, those have been improving for like the last 3 or 4 years, and we've only seen confidence improve for the last 2 years.
Now, the survey found 67% of workers say they expect to work for paid during retirement. And if I understand it, a lot of them are saying, well, I'm going to work later, so I don't need to put money away. In the statement you put out with this report, you say this may not be a realistic way to look at things. Why not?
There are so many things that can happen before you reach that age, 65, 67, 60, you know, 70, whatever the age they want. Particularly, a large percentage of people that actually have gone into retirement have gone because they've become sick or disabled. Or there's something that happened at their employer. They've lost their job, the employer has shut down. So trying to plan on going to 70, you're also going to have to make sure that you are healthy and your employer is still there for you. So that's a really kind of a risky situation compared to so many people that have actually gone through that situation, haven't been able to work as long as they had expected to.
Now, when you look at the substantial number of people who have little or no money put away for retirement, I mean, one reaction is, oh, why aren't these people, you know, planning? Why aren't they doing better at this? Another possible reaction is maybe these people can't afford, they simply don't have the means to be setting aside money. Where do you fall, or where does that seem to fall based on talking to people?
Well, there certainly are those people that can save more. We did ask a question about how could you could you save $25 more a month? And a lot of people said, yeah, if we cut back on eating out or cut back on movies or, you know, coffee drinks. But there's still a significant percentage that says that they just can't save anymore. And that, so those people, particularly those with the low savings amounts, are also have low income. So it's not surprising that they don't have huge savings because they're at income levels that are barely able to pay for their current expenses.
And one thing you mentioned struck me. A lot of people haven't tried to calculate how much retirement is going to cost, how much they'll need to live on after retirement. I could see that being, you know, just not thinking ahead or maybe being fearful, not wanting to know a number like that. Why is it important to start coming to grips with that retirement number?
Because it's growing, you know, it's growing in the amount of time that you're going to be retired. Our longevity continues to increase. If people don't prepare for that, they're going to be sit there. They're going to be dependent exclusively on Social Security, and there is a current funding issue with Social Security. So if they're not prepared to maybe supplement if benefits are cut, they're going to have a really hard time, you know, surviving in retirement. And if they don't take the first steps of trying to figure out what they need and how they can maybe adjust their expenditures, even get their debt level down so that they are prepared for retirement, maybe pay off their mortgage, you know, be in a situation where, you know, your 30-year mortgage is up when you're retired at age 65. So that can certainly help you with not having as much savings as not having that large expense.
Craig Copeland is with us, Senior Research Associate at the Employee Benefit Research Institute. He's a co-author of the report we're talking about. It's the 2015 Retirement Confidence Survey, looking at how prepared people are for retirement, how confident they are that they'll be able to afford retirement. You can join in with your story if you're thinking ahead to retirement, scared to think ahead about retirement, or in retirement yourself. Call in at 800-642-1234. Tell us what goes into your financial thinking when it comes to retirement. Now, Craig, this survey looked at current workers, but also people who have already retired. What were some of the things you heard from retirees about their financial situation?
One thing is that they are far more reliant on Social Security than workers expect to be. Their major source of income for a lot of them is Social Security. And also, we can see that the same type of dichotomy works for retirees. Those that have this retirement savings and this retirement plan are more confident that they'll continue to be able to live in the same one that they have until their life is over compared to those without a plan.
And what about lifestyle and lifestyle expectations? Do people, the workers I'm looking at now, say, have an idea of how much less they're planning to live with, if they're planning to cut back, or are they planning to maintain their current lifestyle?
The workers' expectation is that they will actually only need, for the predominant number, is somewhere between 50 and 80% of what their current income is. However, as retirees show, that they typically are above that 80%. So there's another disconnect there about how much income that they're actually going to need in retirement compared to how much they expect they'll need.
Do you have a sense of why that is? Are we underestimating, you know, the costs of health or long-term health care, or are there other big numbers that we just don't take into account?
Those are two very important expenditures that continue to go up. Long-term care expenses, getting hit with a long nursing home stay, having a long hospital stay for your medical expenses, those certainly are going up very fast, and certainly something that when we actually break down what type of expenses they have issues or have lower expectations with, and it's the medical and long-term care expenses that people don't feel confident that they'll be able to pay for. And that's one thing that really plays in. Another thing is they kind of get into a certain lifestyle. If, you know, if you ask them in the future what their income will be, they may not have a reality of what their income situation is going to be in the future and how their expenses are going to be.
Now, Craig, I imagine there are at least one or two people, or probably a lot more out there thinking, yeah, I'm in this boat. I have little or no retirement savings. Haven't really looked at the costs I'm going to have in retirement. Hadn't thought about the increased health costs. So for people in that situation, what are a couple of good starting points to start first getting their heads around the problem and then starting even at a small level to save for it?
Well, the major thing is to get your balance sheet in order. Get your expenditures now in a situation where you're clearing off your debt. You're getting an ability that you have savings left over, and you have a lifestyle that you can feel comfortable with and can expect to continue if you're going to, particularly you're going to have lower income going into retirement. So you need to change your lifestyle and change the way you think and make sure that you have that budgeting together. It's going to be really hard to save a huge significant. If you're 55 and you have barely any savings, you're really not going to be able to, you know, create a bunch of savings in 10 years before you turn 65. So the quickest way is to get the budget in order, make sure you're spending at levels that you can, potentially maybe getting your debt level down to zero. If you can get a point where you can actually pay down your mortgage in a situation that you don't have to pay your mortgage for the rest of your retirement, that those are certainly things that you could start with, is getting your cost and getting your debt and getting your balance sheet in order before you hit that. Because if you really don't have a lot of savings, you're not going to be able to save a whole bunch in 10 years.
We're talking to Craig Copeland from the Employee Benefit Research Institute, looking at the 2015 Retirement Confidence Survey.
And we're taking your calls on this, too. Why do you think so few people in the United States are prepared to retire? Do you feel confident that you'll be able to afford retirement when the time comes? What are you doing now to make sure that you'll have some security? And what about your retirement savings plan? What have you done there? If you've already retired, what advice do you have for people who are trying to make their retirement savings plans work? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion with Craig Copeland from the Employee Benefit Research Institute. He's the co-author of the 2015 Retirement Confidence Survey.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 with your story. What are you doing to make sure you'll be able to retire comfortably when the time comes? What's your level of confidence, high or low, in your ability to afford retirement? And if you're already retired, what do you know now that you wished you'd known before retirement? Call in, share your experiences, your stories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to Steve in Wonder Lake, Illinois now. Steve, hi.
Hi there, everybody. Well, I have something. I am retired, and I have something that I'm trying to help raise awareness on, and it is what I call the myth of being in a lower tax bracket once you're retired. I'll summarize briefly because it gets a little complicated. But when you're receiving Social Security, I think most people know that for every extra dollar you own, they tax another 50 cents of your Social Security. Well, that's an additional tax on money that you're not getting any more money of. And basically, for people in the 15% tax bracket, which I would assume is a large percentage of people, that can actually mean that you're actually paying a marginal rate of 22.5%. And if you're married, traveling jointly as I am, and you're in the upper ranges of that 15% tax bracket, you're actually paying 27.7% marginal rate.
Got it, Steve. And I don't want to dig too deep into the particulars there, but Craig, is that another expense that maybe people don't factor in? Is, you know, they might think, hey, I'm going to be paying a lot less in taxes when my income goes down. Maybe they won't be.
Certainly that's a factor, and certainly that the exemption for income for Social Security is fixed and it's not going up, so more and more people are going to be faced with paying the additional tax on Social Security. So that's certainly something that they need to put into their thought pattern of how much they're going to pay in taxes relative to what the standard rate is.
All right, Steve, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Kevin in Brookfield. Kevin, hi.
Hi. I understand the concept of figuring your expenses and budgeting how you live. One of the first things I was told when I took accounting back in high school by the accounting teacher was to save 10% of your money, put it away for a rainy day. He also did say invest it. Which I've done quite conservatively, to my chagrin, in the last couple of years. But I was looking pretty when the market dived. But at any rate, my question is: what do you think is an average retiree's nest egg to step away from their current job?
Kevin, I gotcha. Craig, what is a good amount to retire on, Craig? Or if it's more complicated than that, what's a good way to figure out how much we need to retire on?
Well, I mean, certainly that is a good rule of thumb to save 10%, and that's been a lot of people have put that out there, that that is a good amount to save. It certainly is going to depend upon what your income level is and how much. So some people talk about multiples of salary. You hear of your final year salary, some people say as low as 5, some say as much as 20. But it really depends upon your health status, you know, how well you have controlled your expenses going into. You're still paying your mortgage. You're certainly going to have be up closer to that 20. So certainly somewhere between 5 and 20, I know that's a huge range, but it certainly depends upon your particular situation, whether you're healthy or not, whether you're married, whether you're still supporting other family members. There's a lot of things that go into that equation.
Kevin, thanks for the call. As we talk to Craig Copeland about the 2015 Retirement Confidence Survey, a line is opened up if you want to join in with your story about your level of preparation for retirement, if any. What you wish you knew then that you know now that you have retired. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'll go next to Mary with us in Platteville. Mary, hi.
Hi. I appreciate the discussion today, and I think that we need discussions like this to be frequent and to be the norm. Your guest had mentioned earlier, are people afraid to invest? And I think it is a really frightening aspect when you, particularly I don't have a financial brain. My brain has different skill sets. I give money to a professional and I'm hoping that they will give it back to me when the time comes. And I think particularly when people do try to do the right thing, they plan for the future, and yet every day they hear on the radio, pensions are under attack, Social Security is going to change. It really is very frightening, and I think sometimes people are just paralyzed by that.
Interesting points, Mary. Thanks a lot, and good luck to you as you deal with this. Craig, can you give us a little pep talk, I guess, to work past the maybe legitimate fears and still confront this head on?
Well, that certainly is a factor, is that people don't understand and get caught in all that could go wrong. But typically we've found that people that actually are doing more of the right things, they're typically more confident. They typically have better results. However, that's not universal, and that is the problem. That's where some people end up in the situation. They may do everything right, but they may be the ones that retire when the stock market went down in 2008, so their savings is gone. So it's really not easy, but it certainly can be done the more effort you put into it and the more thought you put into it. I know that's easy to say, and it takes a lot of work, but typically we find that a question in our survey asked about, you know, time that you've spent planning for your vacation this year or your holiday is more than the time they spent thinking about their retirement in that particular year. And that should probably be the reverse, because, you know, retirement's going to last for, 30 years potentially easily. Certainly 20 for a lot of people that make it to 65, but a vacation typically is a week. So we need to change that number there.
Go back to another caller now. Barry is on the line in La Crosse. Barry, hi.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. I just wanted to tell my story. I was fortunate enough at an early age to have a father that taught me how to save. He was self-employed, but told me if there's ever an opportunity where I could get into a 401k to start at saving at 5%, and then every year you got a raise because it was pre-tax, you just added that into your 401k, and within, you know, a few years, I was able to actually cut back on the percent I was putting in and still maxing it out.
Interesting, Barry. Thanks for the call. So get it, if you can get a 401k, get it, and then have your raises go straight into it, Craig.
Yes, that wisdom is kind of before the time of where the something that's called an auto-escalation in plan has been started by plan, so it's done automatically. People don't have to think about it. When they first enroll, they say, yeah, if I get a raise, you can increase my contribution at 1% each raise I get going forward. So that's become more and more feature in a 401k plans, because it is a very effective way to continue to raise your savings and push yourself to the maximum savings. And it doesn't really cost you, or you don't see the cost of it, because you're getting a raise and it's pre-tax dollars. So it's not coming out the full effect of you losing money in your paycheck by doing it that way.
Barry, thanks for that. We've got Dimitri on the line now in Milwaukee. Dimitri, hi.
Yeah, hi there. I just had a question from the perspective of someone who's a millennial, I would say, or someone late 20s, early 30s. What can be done in addition to contributing to a 401k because of the scare that's been mentioned about Social Security being essentially a Ponzi scheme and it not being available for my generation? Outside of that 401k, is there any advice? Thank you.
Dimitri, thanks. So a millennial, I guess a good step is thinking about it right now. Craig, what's next beyond that?
Well, first of all, Social Security is still collecting money and still, I mean, the benefits of a promise will be reduced, but there still will be Social Security there. It won't be 100% or potentially won't be 100% if nothing has changed. So there's still going to be some Social Security there. They're not going to be, it's not going to be gone. Second of all, certainly if you can max out your 401k, there are other options, particularly what your income are. You can do a Roth individual account. You can look at investing, you know, finding a financial investor and save outside of that. There are various things that are various products that can be offered through a financial advisor, or try to open your own investment account and save. And or you could do something as simply as, you know, opening a money market account if you just want to make sure you save and you protect the principal. So depending upon how much risk you want to take on, you certainly looking at or going to a financial advisor can certainly open up avenues for other savings beyond what you can do with a 401k, because that's where you can get the tax-preferred savings, but pretty much you're limited how much you can do there. So you have to look at your general savings in favor. And certainly the other thing is making sure that you have your debt in control. You're living within your means, because if you start yourself out in a high debt situation, you very typically have a very difficult time getting out of it.
Craig, good conversation. Are you hoping that your report generates lots of conversations, maybe among individuals, among families, to start thinking about retirement?
I certainly hope, because it's certainly going to be a very important, it's an important aspect for everyone. Virtually everyone's going to have some years in retirement, and if they're not ready for it, it's not going to be as fun as what people hope to when they can finally stop going to work.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.